From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We should not hold school funding hostage to this issue. This issue was created by the Democrats, and to say this year we're going to hold up school funding, the opening of schools until this gets fixed, that's not fair. The reality, the simple fact is changing the formula is going to be hard. If it were easy, it would have been done already.
Chicago State University say it's preparing to close. Democrat leaders won't and haven't responded to our request to meet with the four legislative leaders and the governor to find a bipartisan solution.
You know, our members in just believe to their heart that we cannot just keep raising revenue and mismanaging state government, which is what we truly believe has gone on for a long time. We do need change. So whether you call that the turnaround agenda, the, you know, transformational, I don't care what word you need, we need change.
We need change, Senate Republican Leader Christine Redonio says. Before that, we heard from House Republican Leader Jim Durkin and Governor Bruce Rauner. This week, they are amping up their pressure on Democrats to negotiate with them, pass the governor's turnaround agenda, and finally get a budget for the state of Illinois. I'm Brian Mackey. With me in studio is Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield and a longtime State House observer. Jamie Dunn, Editor of Illinois Issues at the NPR Illinois Mothership here in Springfield, and Bernard Schoenberg, political columnist for the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield. Bernie, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
As we go to air, it's been more than 40 weeks since the state of Illinois had a budget, and all of a sudden, the state's Republican leaders are rushing to the microphones this week to say, oh my gosh, there's a crisis here. We have to do something. Bernie, you and I were with Governor Rauner this week when he said he'd asked for meetings from the Democratic leadership. What's going on here?
Well, I mean, things continue to be bad. They've been bad for a long time. You know, the governor, I know last year, you know, introduced some budget bills late in the session and then demanded certain things. And some of them had the anti-union tinge to them that the Democrats were not going to pass. And, you know, things just kind of spread out. We've gone, you know, into the 10th month without a budget, and it's crazy. Social service agencies are, you know, closing or under great strain. And universities are starting to lay people off, and with Chicago State University, consider or talk about closing. So it's been terrible, but there hasn't really been any give because everybody says that the other side is to blame. You know, the Democrats blame the governor. The governor has blamed the Democrats, is continuing to do so, and saying that they won't meet with him. But we continue to have, a trust and a communication problem because, as the governor repeatedly said in recent weeks, well, you know, my staff called Speaker Madigan's staff and wanted a meeting, and then Speaker Madigan's spokesman Steve Brown will say things like, well, somebody called about having a dinner, and then I guess now they've had the dinner, but, you know, it was just going to be an item of discussion when they would meet. So games are being played perhaps on both sides. The unfortunate part is, as many programs are in severe trouble, and it's getting to look more like, if this continues to go on through the November election, schools, K through 12 schools, may not open next year. That's when the impact of this budget impasse really hits a lot more folks than it has so far, because right now it's people who are perhaps the neediest or, you know, who work, get help from social service agencies. But the mass of Illinois people who send their kids to regular public schools haven't seen the impact of this. And I think Republicans and Democrats are getting scared of that.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we've talked about in the past as the stealth shutdown, right? Because state employees are still getting paid. The state police are still on the roads. You can still get your driver's license renewed, things like that. So a lot of people just don't necessarily feel the effect. But I guess the thinking is, if the schools might not have opened last fall, then suddenly every parent in Illinois might have noticed that the state government was being held up to, you know, as the Democrats did not want to go along with the governor's agenda and the governor insisted it should get done. Jamie, they haven't met since December, I think. And this week, the Republicans say they have, what, 18 meeting dates that they've asked for potentially from the Democrats. I mean, I think that's something that people can really understand, right? They're not even meeting. Are they even trying to solve this problem?
Sure, and that's what I hear, and I'm sure lots of folks around state government, either in it or reporting on it, hear that from, you know, family and friends. What are they doing? Are they even doing anything? And so it's very easy to understand this concept that they're not meeting. The governor's trying to make a lot of hay out of this, I think, by, you know, a lot of these events that he's going to, bringing it up that I want to meet and I'm ready 24/7 and, you know, anytime, anywhere. And not a lot of feedback from the speaker, you know, publicly as to why he is not wanting to do that. But I think, you know, having watched this for a while, you can make some assumptions. And one of the probably reasons why he isn't is because he feels like those meetings aren't fruitful and that nothing is really coming out of them and that the governor is, you know, kind of repeating the same talking points and then coming out and bashing him in the press afterwards. I mean, he's not saying that publicly, but that seems to be probably some of the mindset of the Democrats.
Charlie Wheeler, do you think is that what's happening here? I mean, you've been covering Michael Madigan since before he was even a state representative. Is he just frustrated with the governor's, you know, style of meetings and sticking to his what he calls his talking points?
I've not been in any of the meetings, obviously, but what you hear afterwards is that the governor repeats his same turnaround agenda, anti-union stuff, and doesn't seem willing to give on that. It's all we'll negotiate, but first you have to accept my turnaround agenda. Madigan's not going to buy that, and I think there's a real trust level. As Bernie said, the governor seems to have a, what would you say, he's kind of truth-challenged. In some respects, he'll come out and he'll say something, and it turns out, well, that's not quite what was correct. It goes back to election night when he said, "Oh, I called the leaders." Well, he really didn't call, and we cut him some slack on that because he was the CEO, he was the big boss. He would say, "Do it," and his people would, and then they were extensions of his personality. So, yeah, I called, and it was one of his underlings, and so we said, okay, he's learning that he's not the big boss anymore. He's the boss of most of the executive branch, but on the other hand, there's two other co-equal branches. He misrepresented John Cullerton's position on pensions. And so when you have that kind of thing, and when you have the governor constantly bad-mouthing one of the people that he has to deal with, Madigan is a very traditional kind of guy. One of the things that's been a hallmark of Mike Madigan is his respect for institutions, his respect for the office of the governor. He worked well with every Republican governor before Bruce Rauner during Mike Madigan's time. And it's just, and I think now there's a political dimension to it in that Madigan senses that the blame for what's going on is falling more upon Bruce Rauner, as it always does, because everybody knows who the governor is. Most people don't know even who their own state legislators are, much less who some legislator from some other part of the state is. And so there's a political advantage here. Democrats are looking in November when, from all intents and purposes, it appears that the Republican presidential candidate might not be someone ideally suited to run in Illinois. Kind of a blue state, not a real evangelical, hardline conservative type state. And so the dynamic appears to favor the Democrats. And so maybe that's part of it too. Madigan says, well, why should I negotiate? Let this guy twist in the wind, which I think is a terrible attitude. And if I were to sit down with Madigan, I would tell him, look, get off this, go back to where you go in, you, the other three leaders and the governor, and you sit down and you hash it out. Governor, drop all the anti-union stuff, figure out what cuts need to be made, what taxes need to be increased, because everybody agrees we have to increase taxes, we need more revenue, and then get the deal done for the people, for heaven's sakes. Be statesmen instead of politicians.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I would just say the governor continues to do this campaign-style talk, you know, when he's talking about, well, I'm not just going to let the Democrats do the massive tax hike that they want.
Right.
And, you know, even what he's talking about, he's always said that he's open to revenue, and he continues to say that, but it must come with reform. The people don't want to not have reform. But when he's talking about a massive tax hike, you know, one time Mike Madigan in Chicago at a meeting, a public thing, City Club of Chicago, just mentioned maybe we should start negotiating, go back to 5% income tax instead of 3.75, which it dropped down to just in, you know, at the beginning of 2015, which Bruce Rauner wanted. But then all the Republicans attack Madigan. Oh, he wants to raise your taxes again. And as we go, as I think Leader Redonio said just this week, you know, I think it's $60 million a week we're getting further into debt. And maybe I'm, you know, because the state can keep spending based on court orders and other things.
At levels that imagine as though we still had that tax hike in place.
That's right. But, but you know, and Governor Rauner, the comptroller has said if we just tried to fill the gap we have now with an income tax, it'd have to go to like 7% or 8%. That's not going to happen. So, you know, the Republicans are also continuing to bash the Democrats in ways that don't make them want to get together and talk.
But I think it's important to note with this Republican proposal that we saw this week, you know, it feels like we're having the same conversation over and over again. And one thing that is new about this is that it doesn't have a major anti-union poison pill in it. It does have pension changes that could, you know, meet some opposition, but it doesn't have something that strikes at the fundamental core of collective bargaining in the way that everything else the governor has put forward practically has had.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that.
Well, and it doesn't produce any real new money either, for that matter. I mean, it's, well, if we change our procurement rules, we can save some money. And we have all this money sitting in special funds that we can tap. But what the state really needs to do, and it's pretty well agreed among the legislative leaders and the governor and a lot of outside observers, we really need to revisit our tax structure. We need to increase the income tax rates. We need to maybe expand the sales tax base. If you were to expand the sales tax base far enough, you could even lower the rate and still bring in more money. So there are kind of fundamental changes that need to be made in the tax code. And they need to be made independently of this notion that we have to bust the unions.
Well, let's just recap what the Senate or the House and Senate Republican leaders did come out and say this week. They held one news conference earlier this week calling for meetings with House Speaker Michael Madigan, Senate President John Cullerton, and the governor and them. And that's after the governor had spent a month saying he just wanted a one-on-one sit down with the House Speaker. No coincidence, probably, that the Republicans regard House Speaker Madigan, based on apparently some polling data, that he is an extremely unpopular person statewide. Then later in the week, they came out and said, okay, we will agree to $1.3 billion in spending to cover human services. And these are the sort of functions, just people to remind listeners, that used to be done by the state, treating people with substance abuse problems. Now we've outsourced a lot of that stuff, people with mental health disorders, developmentally disabled people. We've outsourced that to private companies. We've made contracts with those vendors. Of course, those contracts are only payable if there's an appropriation, and there's not been a legislative appropriation for that. So these contractors have been, some of them going out of business, they've stopped taking new clients, or some of them are just going into debt themselves, trying to float their clients on behalf of the state. So Senate and House Republicans say, let's have this spending plan, but pair it with pension changes. One of these changes would be to do this cost shift, it's been called, where you'd have school districts and universities pay the pensions. They chose the salary range only above $180,000 because that is the governor's, I guess, what would
salary
you say?
Salary level.
Supposed salary. Yeah, the governor says he doesn't take a salary. Yeah. But, you know, of course, the Secretary of Education makes more than $200,000. It's a somewhat arbitrary figure. But did this seem to be getting any traction in the State House?
Well, it's interesting because if you, you know, think back to when they were trying to get the pension reform bill done, this cost shift concept was the big poison pill that was holding things up. Of course, now this is just going to be a very narrow group of folks. You know, I don't think it's going to produce the savings that the Senate Republicans and House Republicans think it might. It seems like it may be overshooting it a bit. As Charlie said, the math doesn't probably really add up on this legislation, but it does seem like something that would have more of a chance of having some support than, you know, the things that we've seen Republicans put forward in the past. It kind of reminds me of the budget patch that was done at the end of last fiscal year to try to fund some of these programs that hadn't been funded under the Governor Quinn's final budget, because it taps special funds by not requiring that they be paid back from last year's budget. And, you know, it's just a lot of these little one-time kind of move things around to try to get through probably till after November in the hopes of of doing something more comprehensive.
So is there any value to saying, and let's turn to education funding now, because we saw this week State Senator Andy Menar propose a big education funding haul. I should say the latest iteration of his education funding overhaul. There's a formula the state uses that it very complicated formula that it uses to direct money to local school districts. Right now, property-rich school districts tend to have just a lot more resources than do property-poor districts. Menar's the basic gist of his proposal is that would help try to ameliorate those differences by directing state aid based on things like how many students in poverty you have and whether you have a lot of disabled students or other special needs students in your area, special education students.
Well, the thing about his formula that is so interesting is the current way we do it takes into account how many kids do you have, how rich is your district, how many low-income kids do you have. He would use a district-by-district iteration of those factors, and he would come out with an adjusted foundation level for each individual district based on its demographic profile. And the notion there would be that you would be able to help districts that are in greater need because of the nature of their students, either more students with special education needs or with English as a second language or from low-income families. But the bottom line is that unless we put more money into the formula, if you have a pie of the same size and somebody gets a bigger slice, somebody else is going to get a smaller slice. And the only way this has worked in the past has been we have a bigger pie. So my slice is maybe smaller than the slice that I had from the old pie, but because the pie is bigger, I maybe only get a fifth of it instead of a quarter of it. But overall, it's a bigger piece.
Right. I'm just getting hungry. yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Andy Menar has, you know, of Bunker Hill, and his district covers part of Springfield. He ended up saying, given that people have so bashed his proposals in years past, partly because like the suburban districts were getting somewhat less state funding, even though they have these very high property taxes and they spend much more per student than they do in the rural districts downstate. He says, I've come to the realization we must pay. And what Charlie was talking about, a hold harmless, which is the fancy language for nobody loses in the first year. And he says over 4 years, you know, we'll work in the changes, but we would have to add, I think is it $400 million for the hold harmless? In other words, we need more money at the start. Plus, he wants to add $200 million to help with pensions in the Chicago School District, which is in kind of a pension crisis. So you're talking $600 million. The question then is, where do you get that money from? He says, That remains to be seen. I mean, he basically said, don't know yet, but that's part of the negotiation. But also, he and Senate President Cullerton, for whom he was chief of staff in the past, both say you really need to fix that formula first before just adding more money to schools. That's being directly contradicted by Governor Rauner, who says, oh, no, just give me school funding, put it in the current formula. You know, and Menar says, no, that's throwing money, you know, it's pouring gasoline on a fire. You know, it's a bad system, and you're just going to make the most inequitable system of funding schools in the country worse. So we will see where that goes. Democrats continue to hold a majority in the legislature. The governor just wants a school funding bill, so schools will open again like they did last year, even though there were no Republican votes on it last year, but he signed it and the schools stayed open. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, Jamie, I mean, this is something where I've talked about in the past through the stealth shutdown. I think we mentioned that even earlier in the show today. So because the schools opened, a lot of people didn't notice that the state did not have a budget, right? Is there a value in the Democrats saying, sort of turning the governor's tactics, I guess, back on him? There's a way to look at this where they're saying, you know, okay, you know what, you want a school funding bill? We're going to decide that it's a critical priority for the state to redo the formula before we agree to, as Bernie said, pay money into a bad system.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the rhetorical point that they're getting at there, which is, you know, here's a reform that we've wanted for quite a while and not been able to get, so we're going to tie this to this funding that you really want. It's kind of a tit for tat on a turnaround agenda for the Democrats, especially the Senate Democrats. But holding up the school funding to the point that schools don't open, I just can't imagine would be politically advantageous to anyone.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. Our panel on State Week, Charlie Wheeler, Jamie Dunn, and Bernie Schoenberg of the State Journal Register. I'm Brian Mackey. Bernie, this week, Merrick Garland is still in the news. This is President Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. He met with Senator Durbin.
He did. You know, he had earlier met with Senator Mark Kirk of Illinois, who was the first. And then
the first Republican.
The first Republican, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And then President Obama visited where he used to teach law school, University of Chicago, and pushed the case that Republicans should give a hearing to Justice Garland, who actually comes from Lincolnwood, went to one of the Niles High Schools, kind of in my old neighborhood up by Evanston there, which is just interesting. But so far, there more Republicans have been meeting with this nominee, Merrick Garland. But Mitch McConnell, the head of the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, continues to say, you know, until we have a new president, we're not going to do anything about a nominee. Let the next president choose. And President Obama's argument is that that, you know, goes against the Constitution. I put forward a nominee. You should give the president the opportunity to have this hearing. And so it's become an interesting political football also, because the president also, as Mark Kirk put out a tweet to show, sent a letter of thank you, a little note, thanks for being so open and, you know, just in meeting with this justice and trying to move it forward. But on the other hand, you know, Tammy Duckworth, campaign. She's the congressperson and the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate. There, people say Kirk should demand that Mitch McConnell have a vote in the Senate, which doesn't look like it's going to happen at this point.
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting coincidence this week. There's a question mark on coincidence this week when Kirk is tweeting the letter of thank you from the president. Meanwhile, the Duckworth campaign this week also touted their endorsement by President Obama.
I think they want to make it clear, and probably President Obama wants to make it clear, that Mark Kirk did a nice thing for us here, but we're with the Democrat for this race.
Yeah, I mean, this is a little it illustrates the kind of difficult position Kirk is in and has been in for a while, as we've seen kind of Republicans in Washington, D.C., maybe turn a little bit more to the right, and Kirk has to straddle that moderate line and has been known as a moderate. And so he has had some difficult choices to make as far as, you know, sticking with his caucus on some things. And
of course, Illinois is such a hot battleground, as Democrats want to retake the Senate. They view the Illinois seat as a really one of their best chances to help them do that.
Oh, sure. And just as the point Charlie made about whoever will be at the top of the ticket, it's got to be making Mark Kirk a little nervous if we're going to see a nominee, you know, Ted Cruz or Donald Trump nomination could be really difficult for him.
So this is the time of year when there is a lot of actual substantive legislative action, whether the bills are worthwhile. Though we're going to leave that to the mind of the listeners to decide. But there are a lot of bills because there is a big deadline this week in the legislature. If you're in the House, you had to have your House bills out of committee by this week. If you're in the Senate, you had to have your Senate bills out of committee. Committees are where a lot of the substantive debate, the nitty-gritty negotiations on the language, you know, the periods and the commas and all that stuff gets hashed out. Bernie, did anything jump out at you this week as being a particularly significant? We had a gun legislation, transgender birth certificate bill came up.
I'm not jumping, partly because I was writing a column on some other stuff. But what was interesting is I think we also had the iGold, which is the Illinois Gun Owners Lobby Day. And there's
a lot of yellow shirts.
There's always a big crowd that comes around. And folks, while Illinois was the last state to get concealed carry, people, you know, gun advocates think that our patchwork of laws, we have so many places where you can't carry guns, including on mass transit in Chicago and various parks and things, that, you know, gun-free zone is open season for the bad guys, is what they say. So we continue to see this fight, but I'm not sure, again, our Democratic legislature is going to move in that direction.
Yeah, one of the bills you mentioned, gun advocates were in Springfield rallying this week. One of the bills has to do with if somebody is in a personal crisis, right? This legislation. Supporters say that it would prevent violence and suicides by if you have a family member who's going through a crisis and has firearms, law enforcement could come in and restrict their access to those weapons during this time. Obviously, a lot of the mass shooting incidents we've had in recent years, you've heard after the fact, family members say in some cases, well, you know, we knew something wasn't right, but we didn't really know exactly what to do or how to help him. But opponents, of course, say this is an unconstitutional gun grab.
Yeah, and just as Bernie said, we see a lot of kind of during these weeks when things have to move, we see a lot of pro-gun folks lobbying for things. We also see a lot of gun control legislation that moves out of committee each year around this time and then doesn't really go anywhere. My guess is that this bill will probably be similar, but it is kind of a new twist on gun control legislation that we haven't seen prior to this year.
Jamie, there was also a bill up at the beginning of the week, was slated for a hearing anyway, about restricting access for transgender students, that you would have to use the locker room in schools, students would have to use the locker room or bathroom of the sex designated on their birth certificate instead of their identified gender. That bill doesn't seem to be going anywhere, but there was another bill related to transgender rights that did advance.
Yeah, no, that bill got a lot of attention because we were seeing other states pass similar things. But as you said, in Illinois, that's not going anywhere with a democratically controlled legislature. But we did see legislation move forward that would make it easier for transgender residents to get their gender changed on their birth certificate. Right now, it's a lot simpler to get it changed on your driver's license. But in order to get it changed on your birth certificate, you actually have to have gone through gender reassignment surgery and, you know, have a doctor involved. And some of the folks that testified on that said it's really difficult because their birth certificate says one thing and their driver's license says another thing. And that can be hard if you have to show both types of ID. So this legislation would allow that change without having to have the surgery. There still would be a doctor involved that would kind of sign off on saying, you know, that this is a good idea and what this person wants. And they've, you know, gone through deciding that they want this change, but it wouldn't require the surgery, which can be really cost prohibitive, and some folks just don't want to do that. So,
well, we are running out of time. I know that there were some other bills that we can return to in other weeks, potentially raising the cigarette purchasing age to 21. Charlie, I know you wanted to talk about the spearfishing bill, but time now for notes from the field. We've got about 15 seconds each. Bernie Schoenberg.
Well, Tim Landis, the business editor at the State Journal Register, did a story that there's like more than $20 million that the state owes to contractors who have been cleaning up underground storage tanks. The money is in the fund but cannot be paid because there's no state budget. Just one more thing we see as a problem with not having a state budget.
Jamie Dunn.
And the impact of that would be that the people who have these facilities, the filling stations and so on, would have to go out and get private
That's
insurance
right.
at a much higher cost.
Right. A cost to business and unanticipated consequences.
Jamie Dunn. I have a budget story as well. Some dentist offices closed in central Illinois last week and made some news because they were saying they weren't getting the payments for coverage for state employees. I talked with the director of the State Dental Society this week, and he said that Delta Dental, which is the insurance for state employees, is trying to figure out a financing plan. They think they're probably going to be able to do that. So we probably won't see a lot of dentist offices closing because they aren't getting payments for state employees. They're trying to sort out some kind of financing until the state comes through.
Just about 10-15 seconds, Charlie Wheeler.
Well, Professor Fred Geertz over at the University of Illinois reports on the Flash Index that Illinois' economy is still growing, although it's dropped down half a point. The Flash Index in February was 105.1, but we're still lagging behind the rest of the state. And he said, although the index can't isolate the impact of the state budget impasse from other factors, he said there's growing anecdotal evidence that the standoff is slowing the economy.
I will forego my note this week for time. That is our time for this edition of State Week. You can get a podcast of this show at WUIS.org. Production assistance for today's program was provided by Bob Meyer. Thanks to Jamie Dunn of Illinois Issues and Bernie Schoenberg of the State Journal Register. For Charlie Wheeler, I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week in Review, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week in Review is produced in the state capitol by public radio station WUIS. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.